Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. It's the holiday season. I'm in the giving spirit, and guess what? I'm going to give you your Christmas gift early. I've got a little batch of credit for you.
Okay, hit me.
Well, here's the thing. You came at me and said, what did you want to discuss this week? And you had an idea, and you basically want to do a power ranking going through the top 16 teams in the league, team by team.
Right.
It's a good idea. We might come back to it at some point, but clearly it was heavy on analysis, right? And we just did a very heavy on analysis podcast a couple days ago, going through our awards and our fake awards, which I definitely encourage everyone to check out. But as I was thinking about your latest idea for this power rankings, I just decided to go LeBron on you. I just scrapped your play like David Blatt. I said, get out of here. This really isn't a good idea to go hardcore analysis back-to-back episode. Let's bring in some laughs. Let's make it light. Let's make sure we treat our listeners. And I was feeling real proud of myself for that good idea. I was patting myself on the back. But then I had a moment of crisis.
Okay.
I can't lie, because I realized, who is this person? Who have I become? How am I not wanting to analyze basketball for 90 minutes and instead I just want to tell jokes with my buddy Sharp? It was a very dark moment, I won't lie. But then I realized, you know, you've always said how much this podcast has changed you, how it sort of shaped your way of thinking about the game.
Yeah.
And in reality, guess what? It looks like it's having the same effect on me. I think you might have gotten through to me, so congratulations. You get some credit for inspiring the good idea that I have. Now, you didn't have the good idea yourself. I want to make that clear.
Right.
But you get credit for inspiring it. It's almost like that Kevin Arnovitz piece about Lonzo Ball this week. You know, you might not get your jersey lifted to the rafters, but you did inspire me. And you helped me get maybe my jersey to the Raptors. But anyway, that's all a long way of saying we picked like the 30 or 40 funniest questions we've gotten in the mailbag at openfloormail@gmail.com over the last 2 or 3 weeks. And we're going to go through them as quickly as we can. And that is going to be our Christmas gift to the listeners. So thank you, Andrew, for inspiring that.
Well, and thank you for the credit. I do appreciate it. I feel like we've been good influences on each other over the last 2 years or so we've been doing this podcast. I will say, though, I don't know how to feel, because you also compared me to David Blatt in that little monologue of yours, which makes that the most backhanded compliment of all time. And you're LeBron in this version of events.
You're Lonzo Blatt. I mean, I think it fits.
Yeah, I can't totally get behind what you just said, but I appreciate it. And you're in a good mood. It's the holidays here, and it's Christmas. And you know what that means, Ben.
What does that mean?
Well, first of all, I will admit that I've managed to shoehorn the Wizards into like 80% of the podcasts we've done since I promised to not talk about them. But it is time to address the Wizards. And we have a bunch of questions today, but we are going to start off the top with Ian, who says, how do you quantify apathy? This may be the most important analytics question to date. Forget on-off numbers, sport view data about floor spacing, all that other stuff. All of that presupposes that the players you're tracking actually care. We need some kind of way to capture and adjust for the general I don't give an F character of a team playing in December. So, Andrew, you said you'll talk about them this week. Are any of the statistics from the Wizards season even relevant or predictive of anything if they're playing half-assed for 2 months straight? So I love that the Wizards inspired this question, and it is a really good question. Do you have any initial thoughts here?
Of course. Well, my first instinct was to do like defensive rating month over month. You know, let's really dig in, see when teams turn it up. But that's not what he wanted. He wanted a lighter approach. And I think I went back to my folk hero. That's Patty Mills. And I don't know if you saw the Spurs game against the Blazers, but he was in full Patty mode all over the court, racing around to pick up his teammates after they got fouled. I mean, just doing all the little Patty things. So if we're trying to quantify apathy, I think we need to do anti-Patty statistics. So the three that I came up with, first of all, time a player who's fouled stays on the court before one of his teammates helps him up.
Okay.
that, you know, if it runs more than 3 or 4 seconds, you've got a real serious problem with your locker room. You know, there's a guy who just gets decked in the paint and he's just laying there. No one's trying to help him at all. That's an issue. Another one would be finger pointing confrontations, you know, on the court, like teammates kind of going after each other, whether it's over blown defensive assignments, whether it's over shot selection. Yes, of course, I'm referring to the Phoenix Suns. They got an awful lot of those, especially early in the season.
Right. The Suns like check Marquise a lot Chris. Of the apathy boxes here.
Oh, totally. Because if you don't care enough to fake it in front of your fans and the media, then you really don't care. I mean, that's when you've exactly. lost control of the rope. So if you're pointing at each other for taking bad shots, turning the ball over, whatever else it might be, that's another one that I would keep an eye on. The last one, it's a little more subtle, but if a center gets dunked on and then he has to go and inbounds the ball, how long does he exhale, you know, before he inbounds the ball? Like, how deep is his sigh? Because if you're on a good team, and like the Warriors, like KD's been getting posterized left and right because he's trying to be this new shot blocking.
Block, yeah.
Exactly, right? So, but it's next play mentality. If you're on a good team, you get dunked on, it happens, no one cares. Maybe you laugh about it after the game, it's not a big deal. If you're on a bad team or an apathetic team and you get dunked on, first of all, you know no one else on your team has your back. You're already feeling horrible about yourself. You realize it could happen again the very next play. You're in a dark mentality, right? So when you're inbounding that ball from the baseline, you might just have a, you know, a really long exhale. And so if you can quantify that, I think that'd be another advanced analytic to kind of determine apathy, because, you know, it's just hard to get that energy to go the 94 feet up the court the other way.
Another good one is when a player has like a ridiculous highlight and none of his teammates react. We watched that yep. happen. I think it was Josh Jackson with the Suns earlier this year. Like, went up and posterized someone, and the Suns bench just like didn't react whatsoever, which maybe that means the Suns don't care, or maybe that means the Suns don't like Josh Jackson, but either way, it's
we're
not
so
a good
happy
sign.
For you. Yeah. We're so happy for you. Congratulations. Yeah, like if they react like someone announces their engagement, but they don't like the woman or the man that they're getting engaged to, and it's like, great, congratulations, then you know it's bad.
Yeah, it's tough. But with the Wizards, so I'm going to use this opportunity to talk about the Wizards for 2 minutes. My whole season changed. Well, not my season. I'm not a player. But my season as a fan changed when I realized that the Wizards were just going to screw around for 5 or 6 months like they always do. And so I sort of lowered my expectations. I came into the year thinking like there was a realistic chance that they would go out and win 55 games and be the best team in the East, at least in the regular season. And it was going to be a lot of fun. And then very quickly realized that like all of the same flaws were still there, and they still sort of space out for various stretches of games. And like, they're just kind of a mess. They still have a ton of talent. And they're still going to be a factor in the playoffs. And my whole year got better when I was like, oh, so I don't have to give a shit if they don't give a shit. And it's probably best for both sides. We could just check back in April, and then I can lock in, and it'll be good. And so,
what a championship mentality. Yeah, unbelievable. We have a ton. You say we have a ton of talent. You've got 4 good players, basically. And then
look, man,
if
I don't
have to care because they don't have to care. For some reason, I feel like the Spurs motto is pounding the rock, which is the exact opposite of if they don't care, I don't have to care. But go ahead, continue. I'm sure you guys are headed to the finals.
First of all, you clearly haven't been watching Mike Scott for the last 10 days because he has not missed a shot in 2 weeks. And it's been great. It gives them a little help off the bench. It's true that Markieff Morris has been a bit of a mess this year, but I trust that he will be able to play in the playoffs. That's really all that matters. And you're right. This is totally a loser's mentality, but it's also a healthier dynamic than what I had been working with, because for the first 3 weeks of the season, I was watching every single Wizards game and just straight up losing my mind. My current position on the Wizards is that they are in perfectly fine shape. They still have more talent than a team like the Celtics. They still are going to be in the mix for a second round playoff series and have a chance to go to the Eastern Conference Finals. They're just not going to, it's just going to be an adventure along the way, and that's fine. And I also like, if they can trade for DeAndre Jordan or Boogie Cousins, with Boogie being the vastly preferable option there, they can actually do some real damage. So I'm going to knock on wood that that's still a possibility, but like, beyond that, it's just the same old Wizards, and I can get down with that. Like, Kelly Oubre's been good. It's been solid so far.
That was really impressive and half-hearted rationalization. I appreciate it. The only thing I want to say here, and I do think we should move forward because nobody cares about the Wizards besides you. The one thing I want to say, though, is just before we get 500 Celtics emails into our open floor mail at Gmail account, you know, as stocking stuffers, basically coal for you for trying to say that Washington is more talented than Boston. Are you really sticking to that theory? I mean, come on.
I am. And in part because I'm trying to get myself fired up for Christmas Day. So just let me have this, okay? Just chill. The only other thing I wanted to say about this question is, obviously, we've been like joking around for half the time here, but like, this does sort of highlight my favorite part about basketball, where you have to watch the games to really know what's going on, even as we have all these different statistics to measure everything. Like, a great example would be Boogie Cousins. Like, I was at the Wizards-Pelicans game on Monday night or Tuesday night, and watching Boogie, like, if you just saw his numbers, I think he had like 26 and 14, a handful of assists. He shot 50% from the field. Like, if you just look at his numbers this year, he does look like a superstar. But man, like, in person, that dude is just brutal to watch. And I'm saying this as someone who is like praying that my team trades for him, because I think like there's another level with him, and in the right situation, he could be really dangerous. But like, talk about apathy. He just has the worst body language of any player in the NBA. Boogie has been out of shape for like 7 years now, like openly out of shape. He's like sweats profusely. He's got excess baby fat there. Like, and then he's gotten into this habit in New Orleans where he's constantly starting possessions out on the perimeter. And he just kind of like crosses up people and is playing like he's a point guard, which is cool for like one or two plays. But it just like that's just sort of what he does now, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And so you it's just sort of like a complete disconnect from what you would see if you were only looking at the stats, because you watch Boogie in person and you say, wow, like, I get that this guy has a lot of talent, but this could go a lot of different directions. Whereas on paper, he's like a no-brainer superstar.
That was some impressive gland analysis. He really went down to the molecular level on Boogie's sweating.
He just looks like he drags himself up and down the court. Like, he makes basketball look harder than it is, I guess.
Andrew, he's carried two terrible franchises on his back for 8 years. Sure. Of course, he's going to be dragging up and down the court. No, first of all, in Boogie's defense, he has been really, really impressive this year, especially earlier. I do think it's wearing on him a little bit. And frankly, I think the Pelican situation is starting to wear on Anthony Davis a little bit too. I don't know if you saw his big piece with Wojnarowski this week. It was really weird to see the alternating versions of spin coming out, because you had one half saying, oh, he's gone, he wants out, you know, immediately in response to Davis's comments. Mm-hmm. And then I think you had the other camp that said, look, it's not like he's asking for a trade. He didn't come out and say anything negative. He said he wants to be there. To me, I was leaning more towards the first camp. I mean, when you're openly on the record talking about the fact that you don't know if your organization won't trade you, or you don't necessarily know if they have your back, and you're citing these other examples like Oklahoma City and San Antonio as more stable kind of winning environments.
Yeah.
And you're this early into your long-term max contract, that is a gigantic red flag. That is called laying the groundwork, isn't it? I mean, you're kind of putting some breadcrumbs out there, letting people know you're not locked into the Pelicans forever. And frankly, it's right on schedule. And so again, I go back to my take with Boogie. If Davis is making this noise, if you know you're Cousins and you're putting up 40-20s, and you know you're still having trouble getting back on defense, and your turnovers are still getting nitpicked to death because you have to do so much, and you're playing this weird kind of point center position like you're mentioning,
right?
there's probably greener pastures out there for you. And even though New Orleans is still hanging around in this Western Conference playoff race, I mean, to me, if I'm Boogie, I'm still looking for something else at the trade deadline.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny watching the Pelicans because there are moments in every Pelicans game that will make you say, holy shit, I can't believe these guys are on the same team. And they've actually developed a nice bit of chemistry this year. Like, Boogie and Davis pairing works better than I think a lot of people thought it was going to after sort of an uneven start last year. Like, they play a two-man game where it's just the two of them sort of, like, passing back and forth to each other, and they're more dominant than anyone else on the court. So, like, it works better than you'd think. Or I guess it works exactly as well as you'd think because they're both, like, freaks. But I also think that there are enough moments in those games where it's clear, like, the Pelicans just don't have the right pieces. And it's also, like, Boogie's better when he's playing down low and shouldn't spend the entire game on the perimeter. But he sort of has to because Anthony Davis is there. And then Anthony Davis is not in the right position half the time, too, because of Boogie. And so I think, like, it can sort of work in New Orleans, but it will be more fun to watch those guys when they have their own team. And Boogie, like, put him in a healthier situation, and maybe he won't spend half the game pouting and, like, slumping his shoulders up and down the court. But, like, right now, it's pretty brutal.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure if I agree he's necessarily better down low than on the perimeter, but his shot selection would tighten up for sure if he played on a more functional environment where they were using him on the perimeter. I think there's a lot of benefits to having him out of the paint. He is a really tough one-on-one cover, but I think he's a little bit loose with his trigger sometimes, a little bit too confident in his own shot-making ability.
That's the correct way to phrase it. I think my issue is more that, like, he's just taking, like, a lot of I don't really give a shit shots, which are on a better team, a coach would have, like, more authority to be like, listen, that is a bridge too far. Like, you gotta at least move the ball a little bit, like, play offense. Whereas in New Orleans, it's like even a half-assed Boogie shot is better than, like, counting on Etuan Moore or Darius Miller, who have been, like, they've been okay, but they're still, like, Boogie is a serious upgrade over them.
Yeah, to tie a bow on the apathy conversation, a real analytic to look at for that is transition points conceded. And you were talking about how, you know, they don't really get back on defense. That's been an issue for Cousins basically his entire career. Again, it goes back to this Patty Mills, Danny Green motto in San Antonio. We don't give up on plays. Has Danny Green given up on a single play in transition his entire life? I don't think so. And again, you flip that around, you know, the Pelicans. I mean, so many times it's just uncontested dunks and layups in transition off turnovers. That is an absolute marker of a team that doesn't really care. If you're not willing to put out that extra energy to get back, to commit a foul, to try to break up the two-on-one, whatever it might be, you're probably either lazy or you're saving whatever energy you do have for later in the season.
Yeah, he's saving it for DC. It's fine. The Wizards will coach that apathy out of Boogie as soon as he gets here in February. Anyways, let's move on to the Celtics here. Couple Celtics questions. Nicholas says, why has ESPN been building up Kyrie Irving as a legitimate MVP candidate all year? He's obviously been extremely efficient, but I don't understand how you can consider someone for MVP who averages a mere 24-5-3. And he's improved on defense, but he remains solidly average. He's on a great team that is clearly more about the sum of their parts. My answer there would be, for a while, the Kyrie MVP hype actually did make sense to me, just because his skills at the end of the fourth quarter are so much more valuable than, like, a guy who averages 28 a game or whatever. Like, averaging 24-5-3 is pretty solid, especially doing it as efficiently as he had been doing it. And I just think that we can't really quantify how valuable it is knowing that you could just pass it to Kyrie and he sort of generates a bucket out of thin air in the half court, like in the final 3 minutes. Like, anytime he doesn't score in the half court at the end of games, I'm kind of shocked.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why he was in the MVP conversation was they didn't lose for a month. Well, you know, you got to have a representative in that conversation.
It's not just that they didn't lose. He was also, like, carrying them to, he was the difference between winning and losing in a lot of those games.
Yeah, but also team success goes a long way to making this short list, right? Like, I don't think that they were saying Kyrie was the MVP favorite. At least I hope they weren't. I'm not sure if I saw that. But when you're putting together a ballot of five candidates, you generally look for who are the representatives from the top five or six teams. That might not be the best way to do it. Sometimes teams have multiple guys from the same team who deserve recognition. But when Boston, for a long stretch, had the best record in the league, yeah, their top scorer is going to be on this list. I don't think it was outrageous. I do think they're coming back to earth a little bit, both Kyrie's clutch stuff, their overall offensive efficiency, and their record. We expected all those things to kind of cool out a little bit. So to me, I don't consider him, you know, a top three candidate at this point.
Yeah. Do you think he'll be in the mix by the end of the year? Because it seems like the Celtics are coming back to earth, like you said.
I mean, if there's still a top two seed in the East record-wise, I would expect he would be on that list. But you know, there's a lot of guys who are having amazing seasons. I don't think he's going to generate a lot of MVP noise. I don't think you're going to have that push that like Isaiah had last year. I don't think he's going to replicate that.
Yeah. I mean, some of the stuff Isaiah was doing was just insane. Another Celtics question. Luke says, during the first quarter of Celtics-Pacers, Jason Tatum had one of the most athletic and filthy dunks of the NBA season. At that moment, I asked myself, is Danny Ainge the greatest GM in the NBA? The pick swap with Philly plus the additional 2018 or 19 first rounder was just genius. Do you have any response to that?
I mean, Bob Myers got KD for nothing. I'll take that.
I think Danny Ainge deserves a ton of credit, but I listened back to the last podcast, and I don't usually listen to our podcast, but I did on the awards one. And at one at one point, I heard myself say, like, well, another win for the Celtics. Shout out to Danny Ainge. And I just hope everyone realizes how much it hurts me to say that out loud and how much it hurts to have watched the Celtics play the Fultz situation perfectly. Like, Fultz was my guy. He's a DC guy, and he's been kind of a mess. And it's such a clear win. And as someone who is jealous of the Celtics, like, it's been infuriating.
Yeah, the Fultz situation, it's kind of funny. Didn't they release a health update that was like, hey, his shoulder's looking good. He's going to be reevaluated in 3 weeks. Like, what are we reevaluating if his shoulder looks good? It's kind of murky health updates from the Sixers. I saw some people making fun of one of the videos they released where he was like lifting weights and kind of looked like he was being forced to do it for the cameras. Yeah. Didn't really have the most he didn't really have that LeBron fist pumping excitement to his overall weightlifting routine that we've come to expect. Too early to judge, but obviously Tatum's been one of the biggest surprises of the season in terms of how good he's been so early, and we've been over that. The Fultz thing, though, I would like to see him play 30 real games before we write him off for the rest of his life.
Yeah, and Ainge does not get credit for Fultz having like an existential crisis to start the season. I don't think even people who weren't sure about Fultz, and there weren't many people who had any questions about Fultz, but everybody, like, nobody had any idea that was coming from him. So, but still, shout out to Danny Ainge. I hate you, Danny Ainge. Celtics Wizards Christmas Day. Here we go. Brock says, listening to you guys talk about Paul George and Cleveland, I had to pull over and send this email. Every time I listen to NBA pods that talk through Paul George destinations, no one ever mentions the San Antonio Spurs, and I get irrationally heated. Why is no one talking about this? What do you think?
Can you hear this?
Is that applause?
No, that's the sound of my galloping high horse coming in.
Okay.
I have a serious question here. Is Paul George over himself? Greg Popovich only wants players who are over themselves.
God, I think that's even worse than I could have imagined.
You look back at the LaMarcus Aldridge situation, the finessing that's been going on there over these last couple of years. I think Popovich realized that he kind of needed to help Aldridge kind of get over himself a little bit in terms of what his role was going to be offensively, how he was going to scale his touches and scoring and spot locations and all of those things. It's a real issue. I mean, when you're used to being that number one guy like Paul George has been in Indiana, you just see it in their decision-making constantly. Billy Donovan's been harping on it for all three of his stars all season long, Westbrook, George, and Anthony, about stop settling for non-paint contested twos early in the shot clock. And these guys do it constantly. It's a star's mentality. That stuff would not fly in San Antonio. And I think, you know, if you're the Spurs, it would be a great fit in theory. You know, if you can get Paul George to kind of keep doing his defensive lockdown mentality like he has in Oklahoma City, having that and Kawhi Leonard together would be a phenomenal pairing to go with everybody else they have there. They could play lots of interchangeable lineups. To me, it more comes down to offensive philosophy, because we've seen a big problem for George is, you know, is he getting enough touches? Is he getting comfortable? Is he feeling satisfied on that end? And I think in San Antonio, Kawhi is going to eat first. LaMarcus is probably going to eat second. And George is going to have a similar situation there with the Spurs. He's not really a ball mover. He's more of a ball stopper. So as much as I love the idea of San Antonio, you know, adding major talent here at the deadline, especially if it would come cheaply, I'm not sure it would be the best fit.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm less fawning over the Spurs from me, but I think like the Spurs almost are like a monastery. And so if you're going to sign with the Spurs, you're going to forfeit a lot of different things that typically come with being an NBA superstar. Number one being like the spotlight, because even though the Spurs have been good for 10 or 15 years, there's real truth to the fact that like no one talks about the Spurs. And you know, I think Paul George, this is one of those things where we talk about markets, like markets are going to matter to Paul George. The only way he goes to a small market is if he plays with LeBron, and LeBron's team, where like wherever you are with LeBron, like you're going to be like the most famous team in the league. But beyond that, especially after starting his career for 8 years in Indiana, like I could see him in LA, I could see him in New York, I could see him in Miami, like, but I don't see him ever going to San Antonio with the monastery with Popovich.
I do like this monastery idea, but I do want to stand out one more time for my Spurs here.
Okay.
Kawhi's got the best commercial on the market right now. Have you seen this? You know, bold like Kawhi.
You know what?
The sneaker commercial with the Jordans and the and their like bright colors, and he's going crazy. He's like rocking out. You know, he's got his old school classic car. He's doing the DJ booth stuff. He's karate chopping boards. It's the funniest commercial basketball wise that's out at this moment. So look, the monastery, they've got some chuckles too.
Sure. They've got some chuckles. Sometimes I don't know how we do a podcast together. You and your Spurs love, you've managed to mention Patty Mills like four times in the first 20 minutes. But yes, you sent me the Kawhi commercial. I need to check it out. Anyways, let's move on here to the Bulls.
That kind of proves your point, though. I mean, is Paul George going to go somewhere where you can't even click play on a 30-second video? Because you're just like, oh, I'll probably be disappointed by this monastery product. Yeah, I feel you.
It's like, I'm sorry. Liam says, I've got a couple Bulls questions. Number one, in light of Mirotić's recent performances, who else in the NBA do you think would benefit from being punched in the face? I don't condone violence under any circumstances, but I can't help but think that things could have been different for Tony Snell if he'd gotten a bit frisky post getting his face smashed in. And then the second one is, who do you think is good enough to keep through to the other side of the rebuilding efforts? Dunn, Markkanen, Levine, David, and Nwaba? What do you think? What's your take on the Bulls right now?
Well, first of all, I also do not condone violence in any manner, but I did come up with a list of these players. This is a Blazers fan's favorite, by the way, back in the day. They're always bringing out this idea of like, if we could just punch a guy in the face like Luke Babbitt, he'd make like 14 three-pointers in a row. I think Myers Leonard has been the answer for Blazers fans to this question probably going on 4 or 5 years now.
That's pretty mean.
But I actually think that there is a sort of an archetype for this. I have a certain type of player in mind.
Okay.
It's the kind of sleepy but very athletic wing with like high scoring potential in theory that you just wish would kind of snap out of it.
Yeah.
Andrew Wiggins, I think, would be the gold medalist in this category, but you could also throw in like Harrison Barnes, Brandon Ingram. if you, you know, there's always this idea, if you could just shake these guys out of their slumber and get them to play at their peak level consistently, you know, just inject them with a little bit of Mamba mentality, they'd be a whole different player. So I think that's kind of the answer to his question. One other possibility, though, would be Austin Rivers, mainly because I think he's the most successful player while bleeding in the NBA. I think there's the biggest difference between non-bleeding and bleeding. Like, when Austin Rivers is bleeding, he's just unbelievable. He just turns into this completely different guy. It's sort of like Hoodie Mello, but it's actually proven in the NBA game. So he could be another
one
where...
Why are we tracking apathy and bleeding stats, you know? This is what we need to work on for the next decade.
NBAstats.com, get on it. One other guy, by the way, what about Cousins? Would that have the intended effect or the opposite effect if somebody actually went at him? Like, I'm sure you saw that hilarious back and forth between him and Zach Randolph. Like, if Zach Randolph had just really stepped to him, got in his face... punches were exchanged, somehow Cousins gets to keep playing. Would he play better or would he play worse?
That it's funny because I didn't really put a lot of thought into this. Your answers are great.
Clearly I did.
Yeah. No, you're spot on. I think that's correct. Like, a guy like Scal Labissiere could hit another level if he were attacked. But the one guy that I came up with was Markieff Morris. But then I thought, like, if someone attacked Markieff, like, that's not where the fight ends, and it's going to get worse. And so I think Boogie might be in that category where, like, you don't necessarily want to go down that road, and it's probably not going to lead to, like, more production on the court.
Like a Kendrick Perkins type road where people are just like, you know, police officers are circling the back
locker room, just making
sure nothing happens.
Like, shit is going down in the bowels of the stadium at that point.
Awesome. In terms of the Bulls, I think all the names that he mentioned in terms of the young guys, Dunn, Markkanen, Levine, Waba, whatever, just keep them. I mean, I don't know where the other side of this thing's going to be. I have no explanation for their current winning streak. I really do think it's inexplicable. I mean, you could not have predicted this. I didn't see anyone thinking that this could come, say, 2 or 3 weeks ago. They're all young. They're all cheap. So roll with it.
Yeah.
I don't know why you're rushing to break anything up. Just see who sticks. And I think that process should last basically 2 seasons. I don't think you want to make rush just judgments on some of these guys, even just after this season alone. I would give it into next year.
Yeah. Well, and I also think one of the things, I mean, you're right that the Bulls winning streak is mostly inexplicable, but I will say that they have like a handful of players who are unquestionably decent. Like, Bobby Portis could play in any rotation in the NBA, at least like outside the top 3 teams. Like, Bobby Portis has a spot in any rotation. Mirotić is pretty much the same category. Markkanen is actually like really solid for a rookie. And I think Chris Dunn is the one guy who has been like a real difference maker for them and might just be good. Like, he's probably not ever going to be an all-star, but he is like still, he's 24 years old and he's really solid on both ends. Like, he's already one of the best defensive guards in the league and he's making shots more than he ever did in Minnesota and more than he was the first month of the season. And like, at having another competent ball handler out there, like, makes a pretty big difference.
Yeah, I still really want to defend the idea that it's inexplicable. I mean, these guys started 3-20. They've won 7 straight. You look at Oklahoma City, they don't even have a 4-game winning streak yet this year. I mean, here are the teams that have won 7 straight. Look, a 7-game winning streak isn't like, let's have a parade and
right,
like add a statue next to Michael Jordan. Let's
and
get a Chris Dunn statue next to the Jordan
teams.
Statue. But still, 7-game winning streak. Here's the teams who have done that so far this season. Golden State Warriors, twice. Cleveland Cavaliers, Houston Rockets, Boston Celtics, Chicago Bulls. Tell me which of those teams doesn't belong. I mean, it's not even close. It's like, it's the 4 best teams in the league, and then the Bulls. That is really, really, really crazy and inexplicable to me. So kudos to them. At the same time, I believe it is probably a mirage. And I think ultimately, it's a little bit of self-sabotage. Like, they're shooting themselves in their own foot a little bit. Kind of a Pyrrhic victory or a Pyrrhic winning streak.
Right.
Because they need this top 3 pick. And Gar, like, we're counting on you here. You got to manage this thing. Like, you know, make sure these guys, you know, get some nights off for rest or whatever it takes. Like, let's make sure this tank starts going the proper direction here.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about the tank Like, they're not going to win enough for it to really matter. And also, we should add that they were recording this on Thursday afternoon. They play the Cavs tonight. So the 7-game winning streak, the Cinderella story probably ends and will be over by the time this podcast is published. But it has been fun to watch. And Chris Dunn being good is actually a pretty big win for the Bulls' future. I think Mirotić is probably going to get shipped out in an effort to solidify the tank. But hey, who knew that the Bulls could be anything but horribly depressing? But it turns out they have some fun moments here and there. Next question, though. Alex says, who has been the most forgotten star of the first trimester? Just off the top of my head, is Kyle Lowry still alive? The Raptors have been winning games and are currently third in the East. Yet all I hear from Toronto is that Poeltl might be the greatest Austrian to ever play in the NBA, and that OG Anunoby has a freakish wingspan. I assume Lowry is still good and part of this. Is he still an elite point guard, or have we all forgotten about him? Other names that come to mind as a forgotten superstar: Damian Lillard, Kemba Walker, and the pseudo star slash dragon Goran Dragic. What do you think?
I think I'll come back to Lowry in a second. I think the answer to his question would be Blake Griffin. I mean, after that injury, he felt so far off the map. I was there when he got injured, and I was like, oh no, this is so bad for this season. And then the only time he's been mentioned in the last month has been for a comedy show that he put on at a Hollywood club. Like, other than that's tough. There's just nothing from Blake Griffin. Kemba, I would say, just because Charlotte's always kind of ping-ponging back and forth between playoffs and lottery. Anytime they go below that playoff line, he just falls off the face of the map. But the Lowry, ultimately, to me, is the correct answer. And this is a little bit of inside baseball in terms of like how we talk about some of these teams. And we talked about the Raptors a lot more than last year than we did this year. And I think there's a very clear reason why. We were just screaming and yelling about all the things that they needed to change for basically 3 years. Over the summer, Dwayne Casey and also into the training camp, those guys essentially addressed all of our concerns. They brought Lowry's minutes way down. They reduced the number of long twos that they take. They increased their ball movement. They increased their three-point rate in terms of how often they're taking three-point shots compared to other shots. Mm-hmm. They went deeper into their bench, played young guys. These are things that we were screaming that they should do for years. They did it, and they've been working. So, like, what do we really have to say about Toronto at this point? And I'm asking you this genuinely. Do we just say, hey, we take our victory lap? We were right. They found the right way to do it. Congratulations. This is so much fun. Raptors talk. Like, go Jurassic Park. Or do we just ignore them and wait for the playoffs? I think, unfortunately, you and I have kind of fallen into that second category of, like, ignore them and wait to the playoffs. That does come at a guy like Kyle Lowry's expense, you know, and it probably comes at Dwayne Casey's expense too. He deserves a little bit more credit for the modernization approach that he's taken. So kudos to those guys for addressing our concerns. And I guess it's on us to come up with new concerns. You know, I don't know what else we do, because we screamed until we were blue in the face and they actually listened. It never happens.
I like, my favorite part about that whole answer from you is that you pretend that I was right there with you screaming about their ball movement and three-point attempts.
No, you are doing what you do, which is egging me on. You know, you know where the conversation needs to go. So you pretended that you were a DeRozan fan for like a month last summer or last fall so that I'd really start to go off on
it. That's true.
And it worked.
Yeah, I was playing my part for the sake of the podcast, but I have never screamed one way or another about the Toronto Raptors in my entire life. And I used to have no guilt whatsoever about ignoring the Raptors, but I do this year. They've been really good, and from what I've heard, they've been really fun. Like, that bench sounds fun. I liked everyone on their bench coming into the draft. Like, I was a big fan of DeLon Wright. I was a big fan of Fred Van Vliet as a second rounder. I liked Poeltl. I loved OG Anunoby, and he's worked out great. He looked great against the Hornets the other night. So the Raptors have a lot of pieces that I like. And so I want to care. I really do want to pay attention. They may end up having the best record in the East this year, especially as the Celtics sort of slow down a little bit. And the Cavs, you can kind of count on the Cavs checking out for at least a month. And we're, at some point, we're all going to have to pay attention to the Raptors. I'm not quite there yet, but I feel guilty about it. And yes, we did make it through this entire discussion only saying Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan's name once.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the issue with why it feels like Lowry's forgotten is because it took those heroic efforts, those big scoring nights, those crazy high usage. It took, you know, DeMar's, you know, scoring explosions to start last season for them to really break through and get a lot of media attention. And they've just scrapped that. You know, it's not about hero ball. It's not about one guy does everything. So Lowry's scoring number has come down. DeRozan's is still pretty high, but he's been more team focused on offense than basically any other time in his career, I would say. You know, he's playing smarter basketball. I'll definitely give him credit for that. And unfortunately, I think it says something about what the media values in terms of what they cover, because they should get credit for... No, it's true.
Yeah.
They should get credit for adapting their games and playing winning basketball. I'm not going to blame us. We're talking about it. No one else is. I'm just going to say overall, you know, if Lowry's out there putting up 30-plus a night, he's getting a lot more attention than he is right now, scoring 15 and running a good offense. That's you know, basically what it comes down to. And he's been solid. You know, I'd probably still vote him for an All-Star. So
I just hope that they're healthy come playoff time, because that's the thing with Lowry. Like, he's had all this, all these nagging injuries over the last couple of years by the time they actually get to the playoffs. So we haven't totally gotten to see them at full strength, although maybe that's a cop-out too, because they were mostly at full strength against the Cavs and sort of no-showed that series. But let's move on to a question that I didn't really want to include, because we've done a lot of Jason Kidd over the last couple weeks. But Ned says, can someone please stop Jason Kidd? The Bucks were up 3 with 1.4 seconds on the clock. So rather than make the free throw and put the game out of reach, Kidd tells Chris Middleton to miss, which he proceeds to do. LeBron missed the heave, but still, what on earth are these coaching methods? So talk to me about Jason Kidd.
Thank you very much for including this question, because I spent so much time thinking through this endgame scenario again with Jason Kidd, because he does these crazy things that just challenge conventional wisdom, and you don't know if he's doing it intentionally or not, so you really have to think it through. So I was emailing and texting various people around the league, like, what's he doing, right? So I basically come up with 3 explanations, possible explanations, for what he was doing, instructing Middleton to miss the free throw when he's up 3 with less than 2 seconds to go, okay? Mm-hmm. Hear me out. First explanation, he's trying to get himself fired, okay? That would be a really good way to do it, to screw around at the end of, like, the biggest win of the season, beating the Cavaliers, like, just doing something completely idiotic intentionally, because you don't want to be there anymore. That's one explanation. I'm not saying that's why he did it, but that is an explanation, okay? The second possible explanation is that he's just an idiot and he just doesn't really understand how endgame situations should work. Maybe someone taught it to him. Maybe they didn't. This one seems a little bit unlikely because he was obviously a Hall of Fame point guard, considered one of the smartest guys in the game throughout of his career. Maybe something just got lost in translation in terms of going from player to coach.
Right.
Maybe he doesn't trust his guys for some reason, whatever it would be. Like, his basketball intelligence is another possible explanation. Again, neither one of these first 2 explanations I'm really sold on. The third explanation is my favorite. I think he has sort of gone into kind of philosophical territory here. I think he's like on some Art of War, Sun Tzu type of vibe, where what he's really trying to do here in these late game scenarios is he knows the book and he knows that the other team knows the book too. In other words, there's a general way you're supposed to play this, and everyone's just going to assume both teams are going to play that way. You just make the free throw and the game's over, right? Uh-huh. I think his theory here was, we'll catch them completely by surprise and we'll guarantee the victory. We'll just Sun Tzu them. We'll use their own assumptions against them. And so if you miss the free throw and they're not expecting it, they won't have time to gather the rebound. First of all, they might not have gathered the rebound. In this case, they did, but they might not have. And then would they have the potential to get the ball into a good shooter's hands to shoot that full court heave? So what he's essentially calculating here is that the surprise element of missing the free throw gave his team a better shot to win, a better shot to win than letting the other team try to set up some crazy inbound 4-point play scenario. I can't agree with the conclusion. I think you should have just made the free throw, but that is the best explanation for what he was trying to do. And if you watch the tape closely, LeBron realized that they were going to miss on purpose. So LeBron put himself in position to get the rebound and put the heave up, which just shows that, again, he's the queen on the chessboard, as you said last podcast. No matter what your crazy Sun Tzu strategy is, LeBron James has the right counter for it. It would have been amazing, an all-time great NBA moment. I'm saying one of the top five moments in NBA history if LeBron had drilled that shot from like 75 feet to force overtime. Man, I wish it had happened.
Well, speaking of that, did you see the play like 5 seconds before that when LeBron threw the ball off of Giannis's back and caught it and nailed a three? That was pretty amazing in itself.
Sick.
So,
well, let me ask you though. Those are my three scenarios. Is he crazy like a fox? Is he dumb? Or is he trying to get himself fired? Those are the only three explanations that I see here.
I think,
because this isn't a one-time thing. He's and you wrote a piece about this week. I mean, he's had some really weird late game scenario things there in Milwaukee that are totally against the grain. So which is it?
I would go crazy like a fox in that specific scenario. And I mean, it's not like the Cavs were going to tie the game or win either way, because there was 1.2 seconds left or 1.4. Like this wasn't a make or break deal. For me, I think you did hit on one of the most interesting parts of this. Is like Jason Kidd was one of the smartest players in the entire league when he played for almost 20 years. And he's definitely one of the dumbest coaches. And it's not because of decisions like that. The thing, whenever somebody is just ignoring basic math, it usually indicates a broader lack of intellectual curiosity. And I know that because I've been guilty of it at various points throughout my career, where I'm just like lazy and just don't give a shit. And so
Andrew knows an idiot when he sees one, guys.
At least I'm smart enough to recognize my own flaws. Jason Kidd isn't. That's the thing with Kidd. Like, none of these minor decisions really matter that much, except that they sort of belie like broader failures that he and the Bucks coaching staff have made over the last couple of years. And like even just basic lineup data, like eventually we were talking about it with Moutier last week. You just sort of have to pay attention to the numbers, and like they're much worse when DeAndre Liggins is on the court, and DeAndre Liggins is still getting 20 minutes a game. And I think that speaks to like stubbornness with Kidd and like a refusal to adapt in the face of like clear data that says that this isn't working. And that's something that like I've compared him to Whitman in the past, but I also think just all bad coaches tend to sort of have that in common, where they're just stubborn and don't want to change.
That's well said. The only thing I want to add is, you know, you're trying to write these off as not a big deal. Let me promise you, you can't screw with the basketball gods. He is going to mess something like this up in a key situation, and people who have been on his, going at his throat about this stuff now for multiple years, but especially this season, are going to lose their absolute minds. If it costs him a playoff game, if it costs him a key game for positioning down the stretch of the season, it is going to come back to bite you. You can't flirt with disaster this many times without having it, you know, blow up in your face.
Okay. Matt's from Norway says, geez, how is it possible for two highly esteemed NBA nerds such as yourselves to discuss the worst contracts in the association and not mention the giant fucking albatross that is Joakim Noah's trash fire from seen from space contract? Listen, apologies. We heard a lot of feedback on our failure to include Joakim Noah in the worst contract conversation. And that's on me, because I was the one who listed our candidates. And it's because I came up with that category. What I should have called it was the most frustrating contract, because I was thinking of guys who were really standing in the way of like good teams potentially becoming great teams. So I was throwing out Mahinmi. Yeah. I was throwing out Evan Turner, even Ryan Anderson.
Yeah, slow down. We don't need to be apologizing to Norway. Okay, first of all, Mats, congratulations. You showed a wide net in terms of your understanding of English profanity.
It was good.
In your,
it was
your
really
email.
Solid.
I was very impressive. Your English teachers deserve a real pat on the back. But second of all, the Knicks were a disaster before the Noah contract. That was just one
exactly.
of many, many mistakes
that's what
that,
I'm
that sank them.
I don't even count the Joakim Noah contract as a bad deal because that shit is just what the Knicks do. And the same, I would put Bismack Biyombo. He's like the forgotten horrible deal from the summer of 2016. But like he's on the Magic, so no one cares what the Magic are doing with their cap space anyway. So it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the largest complete waste of resources. That's, you know, the best way to put it. I mean, you could have spent that money anywhere else. But look, it hasn't stopped them from the Knicks from being a pleasant surprise this year.
Yeah.
At least through Christmas. And when you look at the damage done by Parsons and Turner, I don't think you can kind of compare them at all. I mean, those franchises are, in Memphis's case, basically wrecked, and in Portland's case, totally stuck in quicksand after having really high elevated expectations a few years ago, and now just stuck because of those deals. Those, to me, are more damaging. Maybe not quite as outright wasteful because, I mean, Noah is one of those guys who just, you know, he's just off the map and was off the map and had off-court issues and suspensions and all of these things. I mean, it was a truly terrible move by Phil Jackson. But we did dwell on that for most of last season. We're on to, you know, fresher takes this year. You know, new scapegoats, if you will.
Yeah, more people complaining about Evan Turner's contract. That's what the podcast space needed. Let's move on, though. Couple more questions before we hit the podium. Graham says, we need a LeBronzo update. Everyone saw LeBron and Lonzo speaking with their mouths covered by their jerseys in order to avoid their lips being red. What do you think that meant? Just our everyday NBA Illuminati shit, or is it something else? What do you think? Where are you on the LeBronzo theory at this point?
Well, I thought the audio leaked, right? And it was like totally innocuous. LeBron basically said, don't tell people what we're talking about. And then just told him basically to keep his head on his shoulders. Isn't that essentially what
like
he said?
I saw it and I was like, I'm sure he's saying something completely useless to Lonzo.
He's like, I'm putting my jersey over my mouth so we can both go viral tonight. Like that's essentially what it was. In terms of the LeBronzo, I think it makes a lot more sense for Paul George with the Lakers, maybe even as the only star that they land, as it does, LeBron going there. I mainly say that because there is a hole in the Lakers right now for a lead dog, for sort of that veteran scoring type guy that Paul George wants to be. You mentioned the marketability and the platform and all of that. He would, you know, fit in pretty snugly with the rest of what they've got going. I mean, you put him out there with Kuzma, Ingram, Ball, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope potentially. I mean, going small, or you could have Lopez still and play more traditionally. I mean, to me, those are pretty nice lineups. And I also think we should ramp up maybe some like Julius Randle plus parts for Paul George at the trade deadline. Yeah. Discussion here. I think that makes a little bit of sense. So to me, I think the Paul George stuff should take precedent over the LeBronzo stuff. And I want LeBron to swing bigger. You know, San Antonio or Houston, that is where most of my mental energy is at this point. I don't know. How do you feel?
My current take on LeBron to the Lakers is that I could absolutely see him doing it. But if LeBron signs with the Lakers, I think that Lonzo is getting traded because LeBron is not signing up to play with a 20-year-old point guard who weighs 150 pounds and is shooting 30% from the field. Like, I don't think he's going to want to play with Lonzo, number one. I don't think he's going to want to deal with LeVar and big baller bullshit all the time. Like, that's the one thing where I could see Nike stepping in and being like, you don't really want to sign with LeVar Ball's team, do you? And, like, so I think Lonzo has trade value. I think he's good. And I think that we could get to July and see him flipped for another piece that makes the Lakers more attractive to LeBron. Because if you're looking at guys on that team, I think Ingram is untouchable at this point. But if you're looking at other trade assets they have, like Lonzo is number one. And I would be really, really impressed if after a year of Magic and Palinka and everyone associated with that team hyping up Lonzo's superstar potential, it all turned out to be like a long play to trade him, that would be like pure brilliance. And I
look, Andrew, I don't have the heart for the send-off press conference where he throws Lonzo under the bus like he threw
Russell
under the bus.
I don't think he's going to do that.
I can't take
it.
I don't think the Lakers fans could take it. I think that they're tied to Lonzo, man.
I think everybody genuinely likes Lonzo. But if LeBron goes to Magic and says, look, I want to play here, but I also want a point guard who's going to give me a chance to compete for a title this year because I'm 35 years old, I think Magic makes that move. But we'll see. We could do a LeBron free agency segment every single podcast, and maybe we will over in 2018. Jake says, this is another question that you demanded I include. Jake says, with LaVar Ball starting this new league, why the hell aren't LiAngelo and LaMelo playing in it? He sent them to Lithuania and has now created a league that would have been perfect for them. So what do you think?
Well, so the idea here is pretty simple. Basically, high school guys are going to be getting paid right out of high school to have this semi-professional league, and somehow LaVar is going to make all this work and sort of be commissioner and have franchises and all this. If it sounds like a pipe dream, it's probably a pipe dream. I wouldn't put too much stock into it. It kind of sounds like a cover story if the whole Lithuania thing doesn't work out for the boys. It's like, oh, no, they're coming back to play in my league. Well, where's
possible.
The league? The only thing I wanted to discuss with this was during the lockout, I don't know if you remember this, the players kind of tried to organize the quote-unquote lockout league in Las Vegas where essentially they went to the Impact Basketball Gym, which is, you know, right off the strip.
Yeah.
And they tried to sell tickets to fans, and they had quite a number of NBA players. I want to say maybe like 40, 50, 60 NBA guys came through. None of the like super top end guys, like no Durant, no LeBron, but, you know, some really quality NBA players. And I actually like pitched it to CBS Sports at the time. I was like, look, I should go out to this lockout league and just see what's up with it.
Right.
And they sent me there. Andrew, it was one of the most depressing basketball experiences of my entire life. Well, first of all, it was entertaining because like I would tweet out what the guys were like talking trash during the game because I was like sitting right by the court. And then Tony Allen's like retweeting the trash talk and saying like, hey, I heard that too. I mean, it was like this family environment where, you know, essentially it was just like players and like five media members. And that was basically
right.
It. They went on local radio to try to sell tickets, you know, for a lot of the games. There might be 20, 30, 50, 100 fans. And the big takeaway for me, and as you know, I'm pretty pro player in any of this labor stuff, but the big takeaway for me was the value of like what the NFL calls the shield or like just the NBA's infrastructure, the logo,
yeah.
All that stuff. You just cannot take it for granted or overstate how important that stuff is to the overall product, whether it's the arenas, whether it's the jerseys, whether it's the branding, whether it's just the years and years of history built up with the fan base. It is so impossible to try to compete with that stuff, whether you're NBA players doing it during a lockout or whether you're LaVar Ball and high school players, you know, trying to pitch a startup basketball league. We've seen lots of other startups out there try and fail. You see how dismal the interest is still in terms of the G League and how difficult it's been for some of those markets to keep teams and to build fan bases. It's just hard because everybody's competing with that ingrained NBA, you know, lifestyle and, you know, familiarity of the stars. And so if you don't have guys like A-listers, LeBron, Steph, or whatever else in terms of your basketball product, or you don't have those blue blood colleges like Carolina, Duke, Kentucky to pin that thing around,
yeah.
Good luck. You're not going to be able to have success in that space. So,
well,
you know, I wish the best to LaVar Ball, but my experience there in Vegas, it was dark. I mean, it was a bunch of guys who thought that they were going to sell out a gym and they could basically draw nobody to go watch their scrimmages.
Okay, so I agree with you that LaVar Ball is not the person to make this model work. But I do think that there's room for a longer conversation at some point about whether there's just a straight-up alternative to the college model that someone could sell. Because, like, speaking as a draft nerd, if you put 10 or 15 of, like, the top first-round picks in a league, like, I'm going to watch those games. Like, I would watch Marvin Bagley playing wherever he is. And So I do think that there's room.
But let me ask you this. If they're playing with other guys who are not as talented, right? I mean, are you still going to watch when you fill out the rest of those rosters?
That's what watching college basketball is. Like, I don't watch college basketball.
No, I know, but if you're taking out all the guys who go there for the free scholarships, right, and your only incentive is this, like, stipend, and you're aspiring professional players, right?
Yeah.
I don't think that you're really going to want to watch those games. I'm not speaking for you personally. I'm saying for, like, even the draft-obsessed fan. Like, you will watch the McDonald's All-American game, the exhibition. Let's see these guys go toe-to-toe. It will be interesting for the first couple of times, but are you going to watch a 20-game schedule every single night when you have the NBA competing with you? I really don't think people are going to do that. I'm sorry. And I'm interested in seeing those guys play, too. I will check them out every once in a while during a college season, then play catch-up after the year. But when you're saying you're not going to have NBA-quality players around them, and you're trying to play this game of, like, oh, is Bagley dominating this random 18-year-old from Louisiana who just wanted a salary? Like,
I don't think
are you still
right
going to put a lot of stock into that?
I don't think you're right about this. The bar for success is far lower for whatever league, like, tries to do this. Like, the bar for G League success is not, like, is this appointment television for, like, the majority of sports fans? I think that someone's going to make
how it are work. You paying the contracts? How are you paying the contracts? And how are you getting a TV deal? I mean, who's behind
look,
this?
I don't
I mean,
have
don't
a
you
business
think there's
plan
been a-
here. I'm just saying
well,
that
I know.
In the next 10 years, there's going to be a different model and it's going to work. But
well, can I tell you who does have a business plan behind this stuff? Is Adam Silver. He's been thinking
exactly.
about this for years. He's been trying to come up with the best idea, and all we've got is the G League that nobody watches.
Yeah, look, I mean, if it were up to me, If I were running the league, like, what I would do is go to the NCAA and try to pressure them to lift the ban on endorsements so a guy like Marvin Bagley can sign with Nike and then raise the age limit so that they then have to spend 2 years in college and they're making money while they're there, because there are really only about 10 or 15 guys who have, like, real earning potential. I mean, I think every athlete should get paid something, but, like, there's only a handful that are missing out on real money. So if I were running the league, like, I would try to use my leverage with the NCAA to try to make them sort of modernize their bullshit rules and make that the farm system. But I think that there's a good case to be made for, like, the G League as the future model, and that could work out as well. So,
Yeah, I think it sounds really good that we would watch, like, the Vipers of the G League with
I would
with
watch
Bagley
the Vipers,
like,
if Bagley was playing.
All right. I mean, would you pay to go to the games, though? Are there going to be enough people who would go? That's my big question. Could you monetize
if I lived
the
in
TV
Rio
deal?
Grande, I would pay to go watch Marvin Bagley play for the Vipers. But that's a separate thing. Most importantly, I'm really glad that you remember those underground lockout games, because that was one of my favorite stretches of covering basketball, because I was in D.C. where Kevin Durant spent the entire summer there, basically. And so KD, like, brought in players and organized these pickup games. And I share your memories of some of the dysfunction, because a lot of it was just, like, a sloppier All-Star game, but the best moment of that lockout for me was KD organized a game in maybe it was Melo who actually organized the game, but it was in Baltimore, and it was Durant, it was LeBron, Chris Paul, Carmelo Anthony, and then you had, like, random journeymen like Ty Lawson, George Hill was playing. So you basically, everyone on the floor was an NBA player, and it was sloppy for the first three quarters or so. But toward the end, like, it was LeBron and Durant going one-on-one for the final, like, 12 minutes. And it was so fucking cool watching those guys just trade buckets back and forth while the entire gym was, like, just sort of in a trance and losing their mind on every make. So that
totally. I mean, I saw a great exhibition game in Portland, similar thing. I think Jamal Crawford and Aldridge were kind of behind it. I mean, there were some awesome exhibition games. Again, my point is, like, it's awesome when you have those A-listers
yeah,
involved.
That can work.
But when you take those out of it, and you're just saying like, hey, it's the blue team versus the green team in this random, like, you know, 24-hour fitness style gym in Las Vegas, like, who wants to come down at like 2 p.m. on an afternoon and watch these guys scrimmage? Guess what? There's no market for
that.
And
look,
that's my point. There's a big gap between LaVar Ball's dreams and the reality of creating an entire league that would work. That's
yes,
all my point.
Yes, we can both agree that LaVar Ball is not the person to do it, in part because he's offering $10,000, but it certainly appears that a lot of the best high school players are getting more than $10,000 to go to college, so that's going to be tough to compete with as well. But I don't know. That's a longer conversation, and I do think you're wrong about it. So it's nice when you're wrong on the podcast. Anyways, yeah. Let's move.
Okay, well, I look forward to your first report from LaVar Ball, a courtside report from LaVar Ball's league. I can't wait for that
one. The Big Baller League. Here we go. All right, so we said this was going to be a longer mailbag. Let's do 10 minutes of podium here at the end. All right, first question. So Greg says, me and my friend were diehard 2K players in college, and we grew intimately familiar with guys' ratings and how good they supposedly were. But as we played, we discovered that certain guys had seemingly okay ratings, but actually no redeeming qualities in the game whatsoever. Once I realized these guys had absolutely no value, I would just yell, "What does he do?" We always joked that their ratings came from junk stats like awareness, stamina, injury, etc. So my question to you guys is, who are your top what-does-he-do players in the league? So who are yours?
I love this question. So I think there's a couple obvious archetypes. First of all, there's like the rim protectors who make your defense actually worse.
Uh-huh.
I think Roy Hibbert, like late career Roy Hibbert, would be a classic example of like, hey, we're putting him in for rim protection, but like he's not making our defense a better. So like, what does this guy possibly do? Another archetype, and this is actually one I think you've mentioned before, I'll give you credit for it. It's the guys who are no 3, no D, 3 and D guys.
Yeah.
We're like, hey, I'm a 3 and D guy, but I'm not actually good on defense and I can't shoot threes. The classic guy for that right now would be Aaron Aflalo. I mean, like 5, 6, 7 years ago.
That's a really good answer.
He was like that 3 and D guy, but he is now a no 3, no D guy. So it's like, what are you doing out there on the court? We have to mandatorily throw in Evan Turner. I mean, I have no idea at this point
what his value is. Okay, man. Then he got paid.
Yeah.
And it's been a rough sledding for the Blazers since then.
All right. My final two nominations here are, again, from my favorite team, the Phoenix Suns. Marquese Chriss. What does he do? I really don't know. Every possession's an adventure. I don't know what he projects to do. Obviously, athletic, you know, body that just makes your eyes pop. I'm not sure what he does. And my last one may be a little controversial because it's very early, but Josh Jackson.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Not totally sure what he does either. You know, really hyped as this big time defensive wing, hasn't really necessarily demonstrated that. Their defense is terrible.
Josh Jackson is very lucky that Lonzo Ball and Markelle Fultz exist because he's really yeah. flown under the radar this year. But man, he's had some rough moments out there where, like, because part of the selling point was with him was, number one, his motor, but people were praising his basketball IQ and projecting him as like a new age Iguodala, and he is not Iguodala out there. He has no idea what he's doing half the time he's on the court.
I mean, he has some of the most groan-inducing shots.
What
I mean,
this is a good category.
Like his form kills me. I mean, obviously it looked broken from the first time I saw him at Summer League. The first time I saw him in person, it's like, this just doesn't work. But it's not even the form that kills me anymore. It's the shot selection. The idea of what he deems to be an acceptable thing for him to shoot drives me absolutely bananas. And so I would put him in this what does he do category. And finally, one last throwback for you. Another draft bust from years past.
Uh-huh.
Would be Shabazz Muhammad. I mean, what does he do? But he doesn't really, though. I mean, he doesn't really score. And that was all he was supposed to do, was be this big physical guy on the ball, kind of pound people. We know one thing that he does do is lie on his human relations forms. You know, he got his age wrong when he came out of college.
Low blow.
Well, hey, I mean, I wasn't the one who lied about it. I mean, my age is
That's
real.
All right.
That was a true thing that happened. I didn't make that up. And the other thing is, too, he had that, remember that summer awakening that he had where he got just totally chiseled? He got in this great shape. Everyone had been saying, oh, he's slow. You know, he's not fast enough to really make it on the NBA level. So he went to some, like, you know, SEAL or like some, you know, Marine specialist to like get his body just totally cut. And unfortunately, it didn't make any difference. So I would say Shabazz Muhammad, another classic what does he do player.
Okay. Mine are a little less obscure. There are good players that I really don't know what they do. Courtney Lee is one of them. Robin Lopez, Drew Holiday, Cody Zeller, Tony Snell, Jared Bayless, and Thaddeus Young. That was my list of what does he do players. And Courtney Lee is the only guy there that's like borderline because he actually can hit some threes and stretch the floor a little bit. But everyone else, like I watch Drew Holiday and I understand like he's a good guy and is a really solid player. But like I would lose my mind if my favorite team was paying him $120 million because he just is not bringing, he's not taking a lot off the table, but he's not bringing a whole lot to the table either.
Yeah, I just for a point of fact here, Shabazz Muhammad, this vaunted scorer that you mentioned, is averaging 4 points on 38.5%
okay,
shooting,
21.1%
three-point shooting.
Yeah, you're right. I'm not
sorry. I just had to bring that up. No, he scored a few years ago. I agree.
Okay.
A lot of the guys that you mentioned, it's interesting. They're some of them are you would quantify as like they do the little things type guys. Like Robin Lopez has always been a classic one of those guys where the people who like Robin Lopez are like, well, if you look at his team impact, his teams always rebound better when he's on the court because he's boxing guys out diligently. He's a good screen setter. The things that he does, not sexy. I don't think he's ever been as good as the Lopez acolytes have suggested. You know, like he was a center for the Blazers for a while. He had a huge fan base because he keeps Portland weird and all that. Ultimately, I think, you know, he's just kind of a wash. Holiday to me has had a disappointing season. Does Courtney Lee kind of fall into that like 3-and-D category I was mentioning maybe?
Yeah, when he hits threes, he's really useful. But other than that, he's definitely in the like a Aflalo zone. But yeah, it's a good thing to, well, we should track this all year. Like guys who just are really not bringing a whole lot to the table.
I do like we took different approaches to this because you took like real players that you just think are kind of conundrums. And I just basically trashed
terrible
players. Yeah,
exactly. So. I'm not going to trash guys who are on their way out of the league. I was trying to keep this a little bit fair.
My bad. I apologize. That's on me.
Next question is from Al. This was not a question, actually. This was just a criticism. Alex says, I love the NBA, but I'm not a rabid fan of any one team. And I think it's funny when fans get super angry at sports writers who criticize their team. And then I heard Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver disrespect Parks and Rec, and I get it now. I do. I'm so irrationally upset. And I included this because since we talked about Parks and Rec, like I think it was 2 weeks ago, every couple days someone has hit us up on either Twitter or email complaining about our disrespect for Parks and Rec. And I want to be very clear. I like Parks and Rec as a show. It's like a solid B+ for me. It's not an A+ like it is for some other people. Like my wife thinks it's the best. It's probably her favorite show. And I prefer 30 Rock and she's like 30 Rock is shitty. I don't know why anyone would watch that. So people can differ, but we're not throwing like a ton of shade at Parks and Rec. There's just been we don't love it as much. And Ben,
I watched
yeah,
one
Ben
episode.
Has watched one
it
episode.
It was fine. So everyone can relax. I wasn't trying to get everyone angry. I didn't realize what I was walking into. I apologize for nothing. I haven't seen the show. What do you want from me?
Yeah, it's a good show. It is. And Stuart says, if you like the British version of The Office, you should check out In the Thick of It, the preceding British version of Veep. Have you ever seen In the Thick of It?
I haven't, but I'm definitely going to go look for it. I like the British shows. I've been into The Crown recently, Downton Abbey. You know, I get down with some of the major crossover ones.
Yeah, we've had a lot of offline talk about The Crown. We've both been very into it for the last 10 days.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, let's do it. Elizabeth Regina all day. I would say Veep is pretty good.
Veep, is amazing. In the Thick of It is very good. I would also recommend In the Loop to anyone who's looking for a movie to watch over the holidays, although it's very profane, so not like a family movie. But that is probably one of the funniest movies of the last like 10 or 15 years. And the next question here, speaking of movies, actually, John says, your turkey talk around Thanksgiving got me in the holiday spirit, and I got to thinking about Christmas movies and how NBA teams relate. So he made several comparisons here. We'll run through them quickly. A Christmas Story is the Spurs. Model of consistency, won't blow you away, but it's all around solid. Elf.
How long does Pop sit you if you shoot your eye out?
I've never seen A Christmas Story, so is that a reference to it?
Oh my God, you're killing me. It's like the most common reference of any movie ever. That's unbelievable.
Well, you know what? I've never seen A Christmas Story, and for the first like 27 years of my life, I would not really watch Spurs games, so it's perfect. Elf is the Knicks. A kid who has outgrown his homeland makes the trek to NYC to find the true meaning in life. I like that one.
That's good. Yeah, that's really good.
The Grinch is the Thunder. This one I'm not a fan of because Kobe actually released Grinch-themed shoes a couple years ago, and I think I got to let him be like he's the honorary Grinch until someone else steps forward to like inhabit that villain role.
Oh yeah, that doesn't sound like Westbrook at all. I mean, he'd wear green shoes and a scowl.
Yeah,
any day.
Look,
I mean,
Westbrook
on.
Is certainly your Grinch. So maybe the Thunder worked for the Grinch. Home Alone, Sixers, team full of kids with Embiid as Kevin McAllister. That is pretty fantastic. Die Hard is the Grizzlies, the grit and grind of Christmas movies. So this one I did not agree with because the Grizzlies are currently too depressing to include them in this category. And I started thinking, I was like, so who would be Die Hard? And I think it's got to be the Timberwolves at this point with Jimmy Butler as John McClane. Like if there's any player who could play barefoot, it would be Jimmy Butler. And then so Carl Towns would be Carl Weathers in that movie. Have you seen Die Hard?
I don't think so. I'm just going to say if the Grizzlies were a movie, though, the projector would break about 30 minutes into it. There would be a fire alarm pulled. Like, they're going to be a lot more depressing
exactly.
than Die Hard. Whatever Die Hard is, it's going to be a lot more depressing
than
Die Hard.
Yeah, well, okay. So for people who have seen Die Hard, Jimmy Butler is John McClane. Carl Towns is Carl Weathers. And or I don't even know if Carl Weathers is the actor there, but the black cop. And then Andrew Wiggins is the employee who goes and tries to negotiate with the terrorists and then gets shot. But that's a pretty mean comparison, but I think it works.
Wow.
I think it's perfect. All right. The last one was Charlie Brown Christmas is the Phoenix Suns. And all John remembers is that there were no grownups in this movie. So that works. The other thing that I was thinking of is Love Actually has become part of the Christmas movie canon. And I would nominate the Warriors as Love Actually, because Love Actually is also super polarizing. There are a lot of characters in the mix there. Two romantic comedy icons in Colin Firth and Hugh Grant are in the mix with Love Actually. So there's Katie and Steph. So that would be my only addition to John's otherwise pretty solid list there.
Yeah, that was definitely a good list. Certainly one that I could not relate to in any way because I don't care about Christmas or Christmas movies. I'm gonna give you my top five Christmas movies for this year. Are you ready?
Hit me.
Okay, I would say starting at number five, it's going to be the Minnesota Timberwolves versus the Los Angeles Lakers. You know, Timberwolves kind of a grind this year. But in the Lakers, they show some flashes. They're not the best. It's the last game of the night on Christmas, 7:30 p.m. I'm ranking that fifth. Coming up in fourth, unfortunately, sorry for you, it's The Funeral Part 17, sort of like Die Hard, whatever, you know, the number 12 or whatever.
We don't even crack the top three. You're putting Knicks Sixers above us?
I am. It's Wizards versus Celtics. And look, I mean, part of it is the reasons why you laid out earlier. It's the apathy. And if you're just going to turn it on Christmas for me, Washington, I'm not going to be impressed by that. I give you no credit for that because I'm watching at all times, not just on the holiday showcase games. Washington versus Boston, you are fourth. Third's going to be Sixers-Knicks. Now, this is obviously health-dependent. We haven't heard from Joel Embiid since my rant against the Sixers' treatment of him. Hopefully, he's going to be back and healthy and able to play in that game. Ditto for Porzingis. That game would plummet to fifth if either one of those guys is absent. But what a great way to start off Christmas, having those two young guys going head-to-head. I can't wait. You just know Embiid's going to bring the A1 trash talk. Kind of kick things off at 9 a.m.
Really,
for those of us.
It's going to be a real bummer
on the West Coast.
It's going to be a real bummer if he is not playing. Like, I don't know. I'm going to be pissed off at the Sixers for playing him so much. It's going to affect
Brett
my
Brown.
Feelings toward Joel Embiid. Like, I don't care if you miss a game against the Kings or the Bulls, but like, I really want him out there on Christmas.
Number two, it's going to be Rockets versus Thunder. And it's kind of setting up perfect for us to just scream about next week because the Thunder have been playing better. I think they might have won like four of their last five, something like that. They really blew out Utah earlier this week. And they've turned the corner. They can almost talk themselves into being like the number four or five seed again, going against a Houston team that finally their winning streak is over. Chris Paul has got some mysterious leg injury, so they're a little bit more vulnerable than they would have looked, say, last week, and the games in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
You know, the Thunder ramped it up against the Warriors. I could see them trying to ramp it up against the Rockets as well. I think that's going to be a pretty interesting game. At the same time, it could go completely south. The Thunder could resort to their worst tendencies.
You're hitting us off. It could be with like the most obvious takes here. I think everybody understands that, like, why Rockets and Thunder is going to be interesting.
Okay, fine. The number one's Cleveland versus Golden State. You can go ahead and explain.
Well, Cleveland and Golden State, we're going to see. I hope that Steph doesn't play so that we get Steph.
Steph's not going to play. We already know that. You're hitting us off with the most obvious analysis.
Sorry. Look, you hit me up with a compliment at the beginning of the show, so I had to finish off by hating on you to balance out the universe here. I hope that we see Kevin Durant and LeBron go head-to-head the entire game. I think that would be a lot of fun, particularly like if it's close in the fourth quarter. LeBron has been feeling himself lately, and Durant has been unreal for the past couple weeks when it's just been him out there. So both of those guys are going to be going at their jugular. So it's going to be fun.
Yeah. If you guys want some more under the radar analysis, some real
Subscribe
deep digging
floor,
where we just mentioned the top two best players in the league and we talk about how fun it's going to be to watch them play each other, then go ahead and subscribe to the Open Floor Podcast. 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. Go ahead and send us questions to openfloormail@gmail.com. openfloormail@gmail.com. Andrew, I'm going to talk to you next week, but before that, I take back every nice thing I said about you. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. And Open Floor Globe, we love you
guys.
Yes,
thank you to everyone who's emailed all year long. It's been a lot of fun. We will be back either Tuesday or Wednesday next week. And and we also didn't get to like five or six different questions that we'll save for Tuesday. So thank you, and everybody have a great holiday.
Goodbye, Andrew.
Take it easy, man.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.